Hello and welcome to the Freightvine podcast, your source for all things freight transportation. I'm Chris Kaplis, Chief Scientist at DAT Freight and Analytics, and today I'm joined by Jim Filter, SVP and General Manager of Intermodal and the Chief Commercial Officer at Schneider National. Now, Jim's been with Schneider for just over 23 years in a number of different roles, ranging from maintenance to supply chain to intermodal operations and pretty much everything in between. He's pretty much seen it all in his time at Schneider. In our conversation, we'll discuss the importance of leadership at all levels of an organization, how supply chains operated during the pandemic, and of course, intermodal operations. Following my conversation with Jim, I'll be joined by Dr. Enam Ayoub to discuss the truckload market update. So let's get started. Hi, Jim. Welcome to the Freightvine podcast.
Well, thanks, Chris. Glad to be here.
Yeah, this will be fun. It's always fun to talk to someone from Schneider because you guys have such a large impression and you see so much of the market. So let's talk about first your career at Schneider because you've been there for a little over 20 years now.
A little over 20 years, yes.
You're bleeding orange still, I assume, at this point.
Absolutely.
Now, over the time, the 20 years you've been there, 20 plus, the market's changed quite a bit. How do you think the industry has changed over this time period? And what do you think are some of the things that stayed the same?
Yeah, well, let me start with what stayed the same is really the driver. We've changed everything about this organization, the trucks and digital. But in the end, it takes a driver to make that delivery, make that pickup. And so to me, that's the key component here. Now, we've added all of these other aspects to transportation, think about brokerage, digital brokers and the equipment, but all of that is designed to maximize the use of that limited resource, which is the company driver. And so that's what has changed over the last 20 years. When I started, we were using cab overs and the way that we communicated with drivers. Of course, we had in-cab technology, but a lot of times drivers were, stopping to use a payphone. And so they had pay cards right. And connected with us. And now we're getting to the point actually doing video calls with drivers while they're still in their cabs, not while they're driving, but a chance to connect with them very differently.
So I'm curious, do drivers find that as a benefit or is that kind of an invasion of their privacy? Because I know a lot of drivers, especially owner operators, have that independent streak. So is the more connectivity a plus or is that a minus? Was that a challenge to get that connectivity in place?
Well, I think you have to understand at some point it's very helpful, and then you can get to a spot where it's just overwhelming to a driver, where you're hitting them with too much information. And so it's getting to that right mix of what do they really want to hear? What do they really want to know? Providing them that, and don't go beyond that level.
Do you find that the life, in your opinion, is the life of a driver better or the same as it was before? Do you think it's gotten better because they're still on the road for more time now, or are you able to bring them home sooner?
Yeah, the life of the driver is significantly better than what it was before. In the past, when I started, most of our drivers were long-haul drivers. They were out for at least 3 weeks at a time. And now more and more of our drivers are in configurations like dedicated, like intermodal, where they're mm-hmm. either home every day or they're working within a region. So if they need to get home to attend an event, we're able to get them very quickly back home and be a little bit more flexible. But there's so much else that goes into the work and the lifestyle of a driver besides getting home. It's the type of equipment that they're in. How easy is it for them to connect to their leader to get questions answered? All of those little pieces, as well as the shippers that we work with, how they're treated. Are there facilities there? Do they have ways of
right.
eating healthy? Right.
Yeah. That's got to be a challenge. How do you think Schneider has changed over this time frame? Because you've grown tremendously over the last 20 plus years. Has the organization changed dramatically or is it still the same?
Well, our values have not changed. I mean, we still have the same four core values as when I started with Schneider, and that hasn't changed. But what we were 23 years ago was kind of this blended service where primarily mm-hmm. we were a long haul trucking company and we did some intermodal and there was brokerage even back then and power only. So we were doing those, but we sort of dabbled in those other service offerings. And, there was a point in the mid 2000s where we started to focus on those individual service offerings and how do we have best in class in each one of those. So there was a little bit of a separation so that we had some specialization to build out those service offerings. And to me, that's made a world of difference in our ability to provide quality service to our customers.
That makes sense. Something that's happened over the last 3 to 5 years is the emergence of these, what are called digital freight matching or digital freight brokers. I'm curious your take on that. How much of an impact has that had? Has that had any impact? Or what is your thoughts on those?
Well, I think the biggest impact there is that the visibility to rates that customers have, the ability to have price transparency from a lot of different asset providers and have it very quickly. Mm-hmm. You know, think about prior to that type of operation, customers would have to call a number of different types of companies to get different rates. And now we're operating where there really is price transparency, that customers can find what is the rate for different types of alternatives and make decisions very, very quickly.
So, Jim, over your time at Schneider, you've had a wide range of different jobs and roles, from maintenance to ops to supply chain management and now to intermodal and now chief commercial officer. I'm just curious, looking back, which of the roles was your most favorite or most surprising?
Wow. Well, that's a tough one because I've enjoyed every role I've been in. So I'll just take the most recent role, which is leading the intermodal team. I really enjoyed it because of the diversity of the activities I was engaged in every day. Mm-hmm. Working with customers, working with our drivers, working with the rails, and then bringing all those complex pieces back together. And we have a really great team. So I've really enjoyed that. But, looking back at some of my other roles, there's the time in Mexico was really exciting. It was a great opportunity to live abroad again. So I enjoyed that. Look at the role that I learned the most was probably when I first came to supply chain management. I was an on-site at a Ford redistribution center. Okay. And it was just such a big change in my accountabilities and, one where I got dropped in and, first day, you wonder, wow, did I jump in too deep of water? But you just start swimming and you learn really fast. And it was a great experience for me and opened a lot of other doors after that.
Is this normal for Schneider where you have a progression and move through, or is it more of a specialty we're due? Because you went from maintenance straight to supply chain, if I'm not mistaken. That's a big jump.
It wasn't, what wasn't in there. There was some experience in between that part. We had started a cross dock and I was working on that cross dock and I met some people that later went into the supply chain management group. And prior to Schneider, I'd worked at UPS. So I had some experience there as well. But when I first started, when we had orientation, I remember the senior leaders coming in and talking about their careers, and every one of their careers looked fairly similar to what my career has been, which is you do move around into different functional areas, different service offerings, at times working in indirect areas, just broadening their leadership.
So that's something that's interesting. You were in the Marine Corps prior to Schneider, right? And
yes.
So one of the things when I was in the Army, it was very important that you had to have frontline management experience. You had to be on the front line to be able to move up higher. Right. But what I find in a lot of companies now is people kind of airdrop with a master's or something, MBA, which is great, but they're lacking that frontline experience. Do you think that's that critical as you get more senior, or do you think it's more of a nice to have?
No, absolutely. I believe in that leadership pipeline that you need to hit every chain as you're moving around. You might move into different functional areas, but in terms of leadership, it changes dramatically and you need this different set of skills and you really can't skip over a level. I think you just miss some experiences that are going to hurt you later on. So it's really important that you move along that pipeline. It's interesting as you talk about leadership, I think military is a great place to learn leadership. That was my first leadership role. I was a helicopter mechanic. I was very fortunate that I became an inspector, and I was a Lance Corporal at the time, so a pretty low level Marine, and I had people that were corporals and sergeants that were in my department, and so clearly they outranked me, but they needed to listen to me so that we could accomplish our mission, and you did that every day, and so that's what really drove my leadership style, that There was no way that I could lead with authority when they absolutely have more authority than I do. And you can't reset the vision every single day. You just have to find a way that people want to work with you, that we have a common shared, and you don't have to explain every detail. And, you know, that's the one thing that hasn't changed for me.
You know what's interesting? Because my military experience was just the opposite. I came in as a second lieutenant, right? And there's no one stupider than a second lieutenant. And the smart ones realize that. But the challenge you have is, yes, you're technically in charge, but you're really not. You know, the Spec 4 knows way more than you do. And so it's a matter of recognizing that you don't, even though you're supposed to be in charge. So it's tough on both ends of that relationship.
It is.
Yeah. And so do you think leadership at, say, a frontline level, what you were doing in maintenance or in ops, is different or the same as what you're doing now as chief commercial officer? Is it the same? Is leadership leadership? Or are there different nuances to it at the different levels?
Yeah, well, the principles are still the same, that you need to understand why people are going to do something. And the neat thing about that frontline leadership is that reaction comes immediately. You say something and you can read it on people's faces. As you move into that next layer of leadership, you can judge that reaction there, but it starts to trickle out. And as you move into other levels of leadership, you need to understand that you're making decisions and you're leading people that you don't necessarily see. And in the current environment, you spend a lot more time in these situations where you're looking into a TV screen and I'm not seeing anybody looking back at me, shaking their head up and down, or, you know, what are they doing? I don't know. But all those other years of experience of being able to read a room certainly help when you have these discussions.
Boy, it's a much more difficult room to read now when everyone's in a little box on your screen. Right. Yeah, we're struggling with that as well, because some people have done quite well in this environment because one thing is having a meeting with 10 or 12 people, you're all right in each other's faces as opposed to being like all around a table. I find the biggest challenge, I don't know if you have this, is for a meeting, some of the most interesting conversations are the side conversations.
Yes.
With other people. And those don't exist. It's very hard to do on a Zoom or a Teams or these other calls.
Yeah. I do like that. And I asked my team, you know, when this is all over, do we want to go back to every Monday morning we cram into a room and we provide weekly updates, or we want to stay on these calls? And every single person has said, you know what, we want to use this Teams platform for exactly that reason. I can see everybody's face as we're going around, and I can put information in front of everyone, and it's just much more efficient. But then we have other meetings where we need that side banter, and we want to push things around, and those we want to go face-to-face. But also just using the comment section so that we allow a person to continue to talk, but we want to make sure that I'm getting my questions are getting raised and they don't get lost. So, you know, that really goes to the point there. The value of those discussions are the questions that come out.
Yeah, we're finding here at MIT and at DAT as well, is that you can keep the trains running by remote, and that's fine. You can keep your job going. You can actually be even more efficient and effective sometimes. But that brainstorming, that serendipity of talking to someone you don't normally talk to, walking down the hall, that piece is missing. And we're struggling with the same. How do you, when you can come back, do you come back? Does 100% come back 100% of the time, or is it going to be a mix? Have you guys figured that out for Schneider, or are you still in works?
Yeah, and you know, the way I would describe it is everybody's figured out in their own industry how to sustain their business and continue to operate. Have you figured out how to continue to advance your business? And you're absolutely right to advance the business. You're just talking about how we learned these jobs. A lot of it, we talked about our personal experiences, but I also learned a lot watching somebody else in the room make a mistake or do something right. So I didn't have to go through that same experience. And that's one of the reasons that we are starting to bring people back into our offices, especially people that have been in their roles less than a year. People that are in these collaborative roles, and we're doing it safely. We recognize that, it's great. We're able to sustain the business, but, you know, people need to be able to learn lessons, not just by making their own mistakes or stumbling on the right thing, but hearing how somebody else answers a phone. We've had a couple of retirements lately, and people talk about when they started and they heard the guy next to them who, you know, later on was, you know, Bill Matheson, who became our chief commercial officer, handled this problem and heard that same story over and over and how it evolved for that person over time. And everybody around him got better. We still need to learn by watching others.
Right.
That part you can't really do here remotely.
No, that's true. I'm curious. Are you finding, we're finding that some people really liked working at home. And if they had their choice, they could do 5 days a week and we'd never see them live in person. Other people are just the opposite. Where you are seeing resistance, is it generational? Are you finding younger people are dying to come in, or the older people, or is it across the board?
I'm not sure if it's necessarily generational. There's also a position where we're not over this yet. And so people are all in different spots. There's people dying to come back in the office, people that want to continue to work from home. And there are people that we're going to have continue work from home for a longer period of time in roles where they don't have the same type of collaboration, more individual contributor type roles. But those other roles where you're learning from each other, we are going to bring more of those roles back. But it's going to be at a rate and pace that makes sense. And this is going to be, just experiential that we start bringing people back in. And my personal experience after a couple months of working from home, I felt like, wow, I could do this forever. Why would I ever come back in? You know, it's kind of nice. I see my family once in a while. And then it wasn't until I started coming back in the office, I realized what I missed, which was all those hallway conversations.
Right.
And, they went down because our doors were closed more often, but started picking up more and more. And everybody's realizing, well, once more people walk in, it's all those other little discussions that go on that help us. I didn't even know I had a question until I ran into you in the cafeteria. And now we start a discussion and somebody else walks by and we grab them. It's all of those types of opportunities.
Yeah, because you can have interactions remotely using Zoom, Teams, whatever, but every interaction is formal and planned and scheduled. So you must have double-digit Zoom calls or team calls in days. And it's just, that's fine. You can do things more efficiently there, but you're right. You miss that informality.
Well, what you don't see is somebody walking down the hall with a smile on their face or looking concerned, and you're able to ask them a question because nobody reaches out to you with that. We do a lot of, Zoom calls or Teams calls ad hoc to be able to dive into that, but you don't know where to look if they're not physically in the building.
That's a really good point. All right, let's switch topics. Let's talk intermodal. Main reason why we wanted to talk. So, how has intermodal changed over the last couple of years, last 10, 15 years? Is it still the same, or have we seen some sea changes?
I think there's some pretty big changes. I'll start with the rail networks themselves, much more stable than what we were before. For a long time, the push on intermodal was getting out to more and more locations. And, once we had gotten over the hump yard and, intermodal doesn't have the same shock that it did at one point, then we just didn't have a lot of reliability. And there was this constant focus on adding more and more locations. That's really changed over the last few years, that the rails are focused on providing a more consistent experience. But then I'd say the other thing that's really changed here, especially probably since 2018, is the understanding of the impact of the dray network and how big of an impact that has on how efficient a business can operate. And so, that's changing the experience as well, that customers aren't seeing this as some really unreliable product. They're able to understand, well, what are the differences? And now that you have reliability in the rail network, that dray network is starting to be exposed of how efficient that's operating.
Now, drayage is one of those, it's not the Wild West, but it's close. There's a lot of independent, small drayage companies. How big is the Schneider drayage? Is everything you do for drayage, is that company drivers? Or do you affiliate with other organizations?
More than 90% of our drays are done by our own drivers. And that's including, we have operations in Mexico and Western Canada where we're using third parties. So it's a very high percentage that we're doing on our own company driver fleet. But we do use third parties. And there's a mix there. Like the over the road where you do have some large and then you have a bunch of small players as well.
But I imagine it's harder to manage that? It's probably, is it easier to get a driver to do drayage? Is that more attractive freight? Because I guess you're doing it day, you're getting home most nights.
You know, you're getting home each night, but when you're, you know, just like our over-the-road network, it's easier to assign a driver a load and then say, you're going to be gone for 2 or 3 days versus here's a load and I need to tie it to the next one and the next one and the next one. That makes it a little bit more difficult when you're trying to tie all of these different pieces together. And now you're going to do that, including a third party.
So for doing that, I thought most drays would be out and backs. Are you able to do much linkage around?
Well, what we don't want to do is you go out loaded and come back empty.
Empty,
you know?
Right.
So you could absolutely do it all out and back, load one way, empty the other. But the real opportunity is how many of those you can connect so that you're driving out the empty miles.
Yeah. Do you see intermodal usage increasing or staying stable or decreasing over time?
There's still a lot of opportunity to grow intermodal, even on the existing corridors. And especially as we're talking about digital freight boards and brokers as they're expanding,
right?
There's opportunity. There's freight that new companies that have grown up. And I was just talking to a prospect yesterday. Their company is growing very quickly. So initially they start out over the road, but they understand that there's a different way to do this, a way that's more efficient, and there's opportunity to provide that capacity with intermodal.
So is that a hard discussion to have with a company of when, or is there a trigger point? Is it size or is it certain lanes where they say you might want to be considering intermodal? Do they have to have a certain volume level or is it pretty much independent?
Yeah, I think those are independent because, and that's part of the expansion of brokerage that you're starting to aggregate where, as well as our own tools. So for Schneider Freight Power for Shipper, it's making it easier for that person, that shipper that has just a single load a week to reach out to a Schneider and be able to connect with us. In the past, that was very difficult. You know, you're going to call us and we're going to work on a rate and put all those things together. As we create these digital tools, it's much easier for them to connect. And that's why I believe there's this opportunity in intermodal to expand.
So let me ask a question. So if I'm a shipper and I contract with Schneider to carry something from, I don't know, let's say Boston, Massachusetts, going all the way out to Seattle. And so if I have you to do this and I give you a container, do you have the option or do you find that you have the flexibility to decide whether you're going to put it on rail or take it all the way yourself? And so is that the decision that the carrier, that Schneider makes, or is that the decision the shipper has to make ahead of time?
That needs to be the shipper's decision. We're going to give them both options. We'll give you the option to do it over the road by intermodal. We'll do it with our brokerage solution. We'll also offer a power-only solution. But all of those are going to be the shipper's decision.
And do you see, because I know when I used to run transportation procurement events back in the 90s and 2000s, we would include intermodal with the decision with truckload as well, because they're all both point to points.
Yeah.
And so, when talking to other carriers, they would always, if they had the opportunity, would prefer to have that, make that choice. Because as long as they get it there within the level of service, this time and all that, how you move it shouldn't matter to the shipper. Are you finding that's not the case as much, that the shipper really cares how it moves?
It is time-based. I mean, the customer does care how it moves. And when they, you do those large bid events, there still are, I'd say the vast majority, they are doing those in concert, both truckload and intermodal.
Yeah.
But there's also there's some very large shippers that do these as separate events. And it's mostly because it's a lot of work to conduct one of these events. And they're just staging these. Balance their workload.
That makes sense. So there's, you mentioned the drivers for drayage. How do you see the driver shortage impacting intermodal? Is that have any impact at the dray, or is that mainly just an over the road impact?
Well, I think there's two impacts here. One, it creates a greater demand for our services because we're able to provide more capacity. But on the other side, it's also the challenge that we face in this industry because we're also out there trying to hire drivers. And so, there's two impacts here to us.
You mentioned that there's an operational challenge for chaining together loads for the drayage because it's a series of shorter hauls. But is it easier for the driver, though? I mean, is it more enjoyable for the driver? Or do you find it harder to recruit for drayage drivers than for over the road?
We find it easier to recruit for drayage drivers just because you're either getting home every day or you're running in a regional configuration that we're able to get you home on a very regular schedule. If you're not getting home every night and you need to get home for a special event, we're able to configure the work for that week to make sure that they get home on that critical night.
So staying with intermodal for a second, there's currently a pretty big backlog of container ships off of Port of LA and Long Beach. How is that impacting your intermodal operations? Because I know there was a big talk about, especially with the Suez Canal, with everything getting bunched together and hitting Europe at the same time. And when you have a bunch of things hit at one time, it causes bigger problems. Is the congestion and the backlog off of Port of LA and Long Beach, is that impacting your intermodal operations or is that not in effect?
Well, you think about last April, May, and part of June, the country was really shut down. And by July, we were running every container we had and very strongly. That hasn't stopped. We don't have a single container stack. Every container is out there and hauling freight. So if those ships were offloaded and the ports were really efficient, I think it just moved the bottleneck. And the bottleneck moves onto us, but also to all the warehouses. We're seeing customers that are facing these challenges, how quickly they're able to unload all the containers. And so, it gets a lot of visibility because they're large ships and they're out there in the water and easy to see. It's gotten a lot of publicity. But it's the entire supply chain. If you shut down the country for 2 to 3 months, there's just not enough excess capacity to catch up in a short period of time. Eventually, I believe we'll restock, but it is taking longer than probably what most people expect.
You know, what's funny though, we go through phases of the pandemic, and there was the toilet paper shortage phase, and then there was the Peloton, and you couldn't get athletic equipment, and the one I just heard is ketchup. Ketchup packets, because everyone wants the little packets. And it seems like it's always something. I played a game with some other people I work with, and name a supply chain that is not having a major shortage issue. Whether it's I tried to buy a rack for my car, a Thule rack, and they weren't producing because they couldn't get a certain treatment for it, just a chemical, because of the Texas shutdowns with the freezing. And then there's the semiconductor challenge. Can you think of a supply chain that is not having a problem right now?
No, I'm trying to think of the simplest product possible, and because that's the only thing I could think of is, well, there has to be a commodity that is so simple, but everyone that's coming to mind right now would have some impact. And obviously anything with two or three components is having exactly that type of issue right now.
But even I was talking to a bottler and, the restaurant business bottomed out for the first 4 months, five, 6 months of the pandemic, but the retail market picked up. But for transportation, moving things on a can versus moving things in a box, in a bag, dramatically different. It's a multiplier in the additional amount of truckloads that you have. And so everyone I talk to, it's funny. No one really saw what was happening until it kind of happened. And then, we bottomed out and everyone thought everyone would go bankrupt. And then it turned out to be 2020, the best year ever for owner operators. Right. And so the question is, when do you think the roller coaster will stop?
Well, that's a great question, but we still haven't seen the schools fully open, the driver training schools. So we're still not seeing the flood there. And I know a lot of people will point at the number of truck orders. Well, the truck orders aren't necessarily translating to truck deliveries. And even if we had the truck deliveries, we're certainly not finding it easy to go and add the amount of capacity to fill all of those trucks. So I think we're a ways from hitting that spot where we say now we're over capacity.
Yeah. And there's a couple of things that are all leading towards keeping capacity tight. Like I'm looking at the supply side, construction is going to start booming. If you talk to anyone who's trying to buy a house in the suburbs, it's impossible. So that means new construction is going to come. That's going to attract more people that go to construction. And then the other side, I don't know if you had any seen any impact on the new stimulus checks. Has that caused an issue? It increases, people are buying stuff and services. That's great. That's increasing demand. But it might, do you see it taking people out of the workforce at all?
Yeah. Well, when you're in a situation where, say certain days you don't have enough freight, it's real easy to know where the line is. When every day you're turning down the number of requests that are coming in, you're so far under the water of opportunities that you recognize there's a lot more freight out there that we could be moving based on the number of inbound calls. So that's what tells me, even if a lot of capacity did come back, there's still plenty of opportunity to for everyone to move that freight.
Yeah, I think the challenge that we had, when I look back at 2020 using DAT and the FMIC data, which has about $40 billion in it, we didn't see a dramatic increase in total number of truckloads. We saw it on certain lanes went way up and others went way down. But on the net overall wash, it was about, I want to say 8%. But what we did see is spot went up by like 80% and contract reduced because it seemed like there was a lot more moving around of tenders. So I'm not really sure whether the requests that different carriers are getting have been requests from other carriers as well. Are we double counting the tenders? Because I think carriers have been getting much more smart about what they accept and what they don't within that. So did you see a total volume increase in 2020?
Yeah, it is difficult to know what, you know, it's just fall off and, you know, we've declined it more than once and it's kind of moved around the industry. But I guess the question I'd have for you is, well, knowing how much freight is out there waiting to move. So you mentioned the, you know, what's happening at the ports.
Right.
But you see this freight backing up at other points in the supply chain. I mentioned what I've seen from our business in terms of the containers waiting to get unloaded at customer locations. But potentially, you know, the question is, would more freight have moved last year if there was more supply, more capacity to move that freight? And then it would have potentially have increased. And maybe had that happened, maybe we wouldn't be at a spot right now where we're you know, still very much behind.
Well, it's funny. I know if I talk to like a lot of food manufacturers and they face the challenged delivering to retailers that have OTIF, on time, in full requirements. And I talked to them about it and the whole in full, you know, good luck because the inventory is flying from the plant into the truck and they don't want to incur the late penalty. They'll suck up the in full because they just can't wait. So it seems like velocity has certainly increased. There's less buffer throughout the system. And maybe that's what's coming in now in the spring is the replenishment of that. We'll see how that progresses through. But let me ask a question. We talked about procurement of intermodal, and a lot of times in an RFP, it's done together, and they make trade-offs based on that. How do you think it should be done? How should shippers consider intermodal transportation when they're designing their network?
Yeah. I do think that there's an opportunity there to look at them at the same time to understand what's the alternative here. Where does intermodal play, and you know, where are you willing to make transit trade-offs to make that in conjunction? And I also think, well, once you kind of lock down, this is the way my network should operate. Unless your network is making dramatic changes, you know, do you really want to go out there and throw this into a bid each year and kind of rehash it as you go through? And you know, we're definitely seeing more shippers are starting to listen to you. And we're seeing a higher percentage this year that are choosing not to go to a bid, that they're sitting and we understand that there's a cost impact. Let's have a negotiation. Let's work through this. But we don't want to continue. We already have disruptions in our network. Why do we want to have additional disruptions by
absolutely
you pulling your containers out, somebody else pulling them in, or you pulling into some other area? So there's a lot more shippers that are looking for stability in their network.
And so when you go in and if, let's say, a shipper is considering whether to switch some of their over-the-road to intermodal, how detailed is your analysis? Do you look into their inventory issues, their inventory holding costs, or do you take as a given a level of standard or a service level they have to hit? How do you make that decision? Is it an engineering decision or is it more of a low cost to make it within the time window?
Well, there's two answers here for you. The one on the asset base, where our role on the asset side is to provide all the information to our customers and allow them to make that decision.
Right.
But in our logistics group and our supply chain management service, that's exactly the type of decision making that we help customers with, and we take all of those into consideration. What is their customer service policy for that portion of the supply chain? What's the reliability in that portion of the supply chain? And here's what the cost difference is. And they weight those out to provide the best alternative for the shipper.
Yeah, because one thing that we're looking at more and more is shippers to manage a portfolio, right? Transportation portfolio that consists of, you know, dedicated operations, if it makes sense, dedicated private fleet on one side, then some kind of contracts, and then some dynamic side. And the dynamic side is getting filled with a lot of brokers for that really one-off kind of stuff. But I'm curious where intermodal fits in there. Do you think it's part of that? Should you do it along with the dedicated? Because that's more an engineered solution to see what fits. Or does it belong in that over-the-road one-way business? Where do you see it fitting?
Yeah, I believe it's both of those, as well as in the spot arena as well.
Really?
And yeah, absolutely, that there are opportunities within the spot business. And we're connected with a number of shippers via APIs to provide spot alternatives to fill some of those where maybe it's traditionally being run over the road. But if you have a capacity issue and it's not moving, now your economics change and you're going to look at intermodal and be willing to do something a little bit differently there.
That makes sense. Now, you mentioned APIs. Now, reading the literature and what I see in the press, only digital freight brokers have APIs. What's a large asset-based carrier doing with an API?
Well, the number of APIs is increasing day by day, and it's us connecting with, we do connect with brokers, we connect with large shippers, but even medium-sized shippers that, you know, it's a fairly simple connection, and then we're able to plumb directly into their TMS. And so they're able to have the visibility that we were talking about earlier.
So do you see, I was talking with Doug Wagner on a previous episode, and I asked them, what will it take for APIs to supersede EDI? Will EDI ever go away? It's such a dominant communication still. Do you see a day where it will go away, or do you think we're going to be talking about it in 50 years? Well, not us individual, other
50
people.
50 years from now, I think APIs are gone in 50 years. I think, you know, you're probably two generations away from in 50 years. But, you know, and seriously, you know, APIs are, you know, the way that this industry is trending now. But I believe there will probably be another generation that comes in much quicker. This EDI held that space for so long. I think each generation kind of morphs here a little bit faster than the next.
But it's easier to change, easier to plug and play. Let me ask you some quick questions about Mexico, because you were down there for 2 years, I believe, 2010, 2012. You mentioned it, you were able to live abroad again. What was it like living and working in Mexico? Was it a dramatic difference, or was it... What was it like?
Yeah, well, you know, I loved my experience there, and it was a great experience for my family as well. I had lived abroad when I was in service, and I'm sure you and the Army as well, that experience of looking at your country differently when you're not in the middle of it. And to me, that was a great experience, as well as professionally. That opportunity that, you know, my role had me connecting with government agencies that, I just didn't have that when I was in the U.S., to the extent that I had in that role. And then the broader accountabilities for a business. And it was really enjoyable. I had a great team down there, learned a lot. But I was also able to bring, some of what I had learned in the U.S. and share that with the team down there.
Did you were only there for 2 years? Is that right?
I was there for 2 years.
Is that a normal rotation? Because I know sometimes you rotate to a job and you really just figure out where the bathroom is after 1 year. Second year, you're getting there and then you're gone. Is that the case, or would you have stayed longer if you could?
I would have loved to have stayed longer. Matter of fact, they were pulling me out of that spot. But primarily, what we want is a Mexican national running that Mexico business. So a big part of my role there was to find someone And wow. I was very fortunate that within the first couple months, I found someone and was able to bring him onto my team and put him in a role and then advance him and then advance him again and broaden his experience. And then at that point, I was tapped on the shoulder and said, you know what? We've got the right person there.
Time to come back. Back to Wisconsin.
That's right. So
recent news about the Canada Pacific and the KFU merger acquisition. What are your thoughts? I know you get nothing official, but what do you think that'll do to that corridor? Or what are your thoughts on that acquisition and merger?
Yeah, you know, I know there's always discussions of, well, there's all this freight that crosses the border in trucks. Shouldn't it all go on intermodal? And, you know, you could take any border in this country, the border between Illinois and Wisconsin, say, well, there's a lot of trucks crossing. Well, that doesn't mean that those trucks are necessarily going a long distance. They just happen to be going over the border. So when you look at that data, you know, you need to look at, well, how far is it coming into the U.S.? And by far, Texas is the biggest trading partner with Mexico. And so there's a lot of freight that's just going up to Dallas. That's right. Number one. And so you have to, that's not a great length of haul for intermodal to go from Monterrey to Dallas. But the other challenge that you have here, and the reason why Texas shows up, are Incoterms. By far, the largest Incoterm is delivered at the frontier. So most freight needs to change hands at the frontier. And we'll help customers be able to negotiate and look at, the, you know, there's a better option here if we deliver from end to end. But there's a broker that's in between there, the customs broker, not the freight broker, a customs broker that, you know, they're, you know, what's in it for them is they want that freight to be delivered at the frontier because they get to touch it. And so as well as you have a U.S. decision maker, a Mexican decision maker, and one of those is going to lose some authority when you do an end-to-end move. So when I look at it, I think about, you know, you have freight that is running over the road, but how much of it is actually being stopped at the border because of the Incoterms? Or how much of it has a very short length of haul? If we just look at the freight that's going truly door to door, and by that I mean it's in the same trailer or container, going from you know, Mexico to the Midwest or the Northeast, that penetration for intermodal is actually much higher. It looks more like what you would see out of Southern California when you think about it in those terms. There's still opportunities for conversion, absolutely. But it's not nearly the low percentages that get reported because, you know, they're including where the Incoterms are delivered at the frontier.
What about going the other way? Is there much, or do you see their potential to be Canada to Mexico or Mexico to Canada? I believe, is there a lot of energy movement?
I believe that would be the majority of it, probably not intermodal. So you're looking at some boxcars and tankers that are moving that direction.
But do you think, and this is just an opinion, do you think it'll remove trucks from the highway, increase or have minimal effect?
I believe it's going to have minimal effect because there's no additional service offering that's being created here. There's no additional service lane that suddenly becomes available. You know, you can get from Canada in the Midwest to Mexico today, all parts. What you know hasn't been established yet are necessarily what their services are. So how they're going to connect with other railroads. We also haven't seen a service plan, a service continuity plan. Those are things that are going to have to be shared first.
All right. Last question, and I'll let you go, Jim. Pandemic is showing signs of easing, knock on wood. I don't know if you've been vaccinated yet. Have you gotten your vaccines? I just became eligible in Massachusetts, and I'm like checking the website to see where I can go. And all the
we can create a bot for you.
There you go. All the open appointments are like at the other end of the state. So, but we'll figure it out. But now that it's showing signs of easing, are there any silver linings? Are there any things that you had to do or your company did during the pandemic that you think will live beyond the pandemic?
Yeah, and I hate to say that there's a silver lining because the reality is that this pandemic has been extremely impactful for a lot of people in this country and around the world, and it's not over. So it's very difficult to say that there's a silver lining. Having said that, you know, we've talked about working from home and that is absolutely something that we're going to be able to connect with people a little bit differently in the future. But for me, the brightest spot out of all of this is that the broader public is seeing the impact of the supply chain and how important it is. Last week, my mom, who's 80 years old, asked me about the ships sitting off the coast of California. And I thought, I've been in this business over 20 years. I don't think she really knows what I do. And she's asking me about supply chain. And man, I thought, that's really great. Now, if my 80-year-old mother is asking me about the supply chain and taking an interest in it after all these years, that tells me that people are starting to look at what happens here and the importance of that professional driver making that delivery. That's really what sustains all of our lifestyles. And people are starting to connect that, you know, we've lived for so long with the shelves being full. We've never experienced that. Well, empty shelves is something that happened in other countries.
Yeah, but that's
what finally happened here. That's the first time in my lifetime where I've seen empty store shelves to the extent that we did, that people understand, well, you know, we don't take that for granted. There's a lot of people that work really hard to make that happen. So
that's a really, really good point. Yeah, the visibility of transportation, especially for trucking, that it never stopped moving, right? Yeah. Things, the supply chains never stopped.
And there's so many people. It's, I mean, what you do, what, you know, our companies do, what the drivers, all of that, those different activities are absolutely what's required to make this country run.
And it's invisible to a lot of people. I know when I was for freight transportation, people thought I wore an orange vest on the side of the highway, right? So it's great. Yeah, that's a really good point. More visibility to the profession, to the industry, and especially the drivers. I think there's a lot more appreciation.
Yeah, a lot of pride.
Well, thanks, Jim. I enjoyed talking with you.
Thank you, Chris. I've enjoyed our time together.
Yeah. Okay, everyone, stay tuned for the Truckload Market Update with Dr. Enam Eyoob.
Welcome to the Over-the-Road Truckload Market Update for May 20th, 2021. In today's market update, we will discuss the market changes in the last 2 weeks. Let's start with dry van. Active rates are up 1.6%, spot rates up 1%, replacement rate is positive 5%. This means the new contract rates are about 5% above the rates being replaced. On the temp control side, active rates are up 1.5%, spot rates up 0.5%, and replacement rates positive 10%. On the intermodal side, active rates are up 1%, spot rates up 1%, and replacement rate is positive 4%. Finally, on the flatbed side, active rates up 3%, spot rates up 1%, and replacement rate is positive 5%.
So, Enam, this is a little bit of a change this week. What are you seeing? What are the big takeaways?
I think the biggest takeaway is that the spot rates were dropping in the last few weeks, but now we see the direction changed again. So we see the spot rates climbing back up. Other than the spot, you know, active rates were climbing in the last few weeks. The the replacement rates were positive. The hope was that if the spot rates continue to drop, maybe the direction of the active rates and the replacement rates will flatten out. But now with the spot rates going back up.
So what do you think is causing the spot rates to go back up? Because like you said, we've seen this for what, 4 or 5 updates in a row, they've been dropping from their highs. What's causing that?
Well, something that we had discussed in the previous updates as well. Typically, the summertime period starting from end of May, June, July time period is a seasonally higher rate time period, which may be driven also by the produce seasons and so forth. So that's seasonally, that's a typically high time. But in this particular case, now, as we are getting into that time period, we are also having an external, it's kind of an external or anomalous situation where we are also coming out of the COVID. So more things are opening up. And so we might have an external factor that might be driving.
Yeah. Demand is definitely up across the board. It's hard to find any supply chain that is not having demand through the roof or expected demand. So there's a lot of restocking going on. People think the sales will continue as they go. I was just reading that Walmart had a record quarter again, although some sales are starting to decline at a lower rate than they were in the pandemic. Home Depot is still doing really strong sales coming in. But then, so there's still a lot of restocking going on. So demand is definitely high. What do you think about supply? Do you think supply is tightened or do you think that has had an effect at all? What are your thoughts?
I think even for the supply, if you're talking about the trucks and so forth, I think that, even for the new trucks to come into the market, they themselves are getting caught on the other end with some of the supply chain problems.
Right.
So I think, all the trucks that were supposed to hit the second and third quarter are getting, getting held up.
Right. So and then it seems like, all the supply chains are messed up. And then also coming in on the West Coast, there's still a backlog, although it looks like the backlog is starting to be cut down. I heard maybe by midsummer that the backlog should be down to regular processing times. But all in all, it seems like demand is driving a lot of this with some of the challenges with the supply chains and the restocking. So what do you expect? When do you expect this to start calming down, the cycle to start finishing?
I think, it's end of third quarter, based on the cycle. And if we can catch a breath, just like typically we used to catch a breath in March, April, April timeframe. So the hope now is, can we catch a breath in late third quarter before the fourth quarter picks up?
Yep, that makes sense. All right, any last words before we close out the update?
No, I think, the procurement events, from what we are hearing, all the procurement events are still going on. But, shippers are taking a very intelligent approach of taking a, which we always talk about, is a portfolio approach of trying to manage it, intelligently rather than, putting everything out there.
Okay. Well, that concludes this week's Truckload Market Update. Thanks, Eno.
Thank you.
Well, that wraps up this episode of The Freightvine. The Freightvine podcast is hosted by Dr. Enam Ayoub and myself, Chris Kaplis, and is produced and edited by DATIQ. For more information or to hear previous episodes, please visit our website at dat.com/podcasts. You can subscribe to The Freightvine wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, be sure to give us a review. As always, if you have any feedback or questions about what you've heard on The Freightvine or suggestions for what you'd like to hear in the future, send an email to me at chris.kaplis@dat.com. Finally, from all of us at The Freightvine, thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed it and learned something new.